2009, February 9th. Today, Astronomy 141, Lecture 25, The Requirements of Life. Okay. Oops. We've looked at the solar system. We've seen the terrestrial planets. We've seen the gas giants, the Jovian planets. And we've looked at them as from a point of view of what their properties are, what their surfaces are or lack thereof, what their composition is, what chemistry is important. Oxidizing chemistry on the Earth-like planets, reducing hydrogen chemistry on the gas giants. We will now ask the question of where should we be looking among these worlds for life? On the terrestrial planets, perhaps the moons of the Jovian planets, or even the Jovian planets themselves. But to ask that question sensibly, we have to review what are the requirements for life. Now I'm going to take together a lot of stuff we've had in previous lectures, and I'm now going to review it, but in this context of how we set a series of requirements to define what we're going to go searching for. So today, what I'm going to do is exploring what the requirements of life are to try to understand what are the factors that affect planetary habitability. Where should I be looking for life to occur? What planetary surfaces are habitable, or at least hospitable to life? The basic requirements are going to turn out to be ones we've already seen before. You've got to have a source of energy to drive metabolism. You've got to have some complex chemistry going on because you need things like catalytic reactions and all the really complex chemistry that makes up cellular life as we understand it, or even relatively simple forms of life or quasi-life like viruses are still chemically very complex. You need a liquid solvent medium, we think. Most likely liquid water, but there are others. And you need protection from ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation damages genetic material as we understand it. That makes for large amounts of mutations. Those mutations get passed on through heredity and could often do bad things, often are sterilizing in some cases. We're going to see that sunlight is the main source of energy for the solar system, we think, but how much energy you get from sunlight depends upon how far away you are from the sun and how shiny your surface is. However, sunlight's not the only story. Extremophiles, we've seen extreme forms of life that live deep in the ocean, deep underground, tell us that non-solar sources of energy may in fact be important as a factor in habitability. So we shouldn't just be looking at places that are warmed by the sun, but which there may be other sources of energy that can provide heat other than sunlight. So maybe we shouldn't be so provincial as to think of only the warm, sunny places. It may be warm other sources of energy places as well. We see examples on the Earth that tell us that we should relax that assumption. We think liquid water fills the requirement of this ideal solvent, but we're going to see there are some other liquids that might actually fill the bill, that have some properties that also make them liquid solvents. We're going to look at a couple of those today and a little bit later in the class when we look at more extreme possibilities for life. And finally, one of the things that seems to be important that we've picked up on when we talked about the Earth and talked about the terrestrial planets is some of the major differences between the terrestrial planets were due to the size of the planet. And of course, the Jovians are very large, so their size has a role in determining their properties, and their properties play a strong role in saying, are they inhabitable? So we're going to see it may be the planet size will determine things like how much internal heat you have, which drives tectonics, whether or not you have a magnetic field, which will turn out to be important, and it also the size in terms of the gravity of that planet is one of the important factors combined with the amount of solar heating that determines your ability to hold on to an atmosphere, hold on to those gases that include, among other things, water vapor, carbon dioxide, the things we think are important for life. So this is where we're going with this. We're going to try to take all we've learned about life on Earth and some of its extreme properties, what we've learned about the solar system in the last couple days, and try to break down what are the requirements of how we actually narrow our search through all the stuff in the solar system. The basic requirements for life, just as, again, said it here before, but I'll go through it again, we need a source of energy. The source of energy is to fuel chemical reactions. And also, if we think liquid water is essential, you've got to be at a temperature where water is liquid. So it actually provides a source of warmth. If we admit other liquids, then the temperature's got to be where those molecules are liquid. Because if you make it too hot, it's a vapor. You make it too cold, it freezes into an ice. You've got to be in that just right zone where everything's liquid. We know that you need complex chemistry, which means you need elements heavier than hydrogen, helium. Hydrogen is certainly important. It's one of the four elements of life, hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. Helium is useless. It's totally chemically inert. But pure hydrogen alone doesn't have complex chemistry. It has a reducing chemistry. We know that a lot of the complex molecules that we know of in the universe, not just on Earth, but throughout the universe, are carbon compounds. Carbon has this amazing ability to produce very complex molecules, very, very rich chemistry results of that. You add nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen, and you get things like amino acids, the basic structures of life. We see these coming in interstellar space, we see them in meteorites, and of course we find them on the Earth, as we've seen before. So this complex chemistry appears to us to be carbon chemistry. Are there other kinds of chemistry that could give this kind of complex chemistry? The answer is yes, maybe, and we're going to explore those a little bit later in the class. But now we want to stick with carbon chemistry, because we find carbon chemistry throughout the solar system, so it's a good place to start. The complex chemistry has to occur someplace. Either it has to occur in gas phase, like in clouds, it has to occur on a surface, but most of the chemistry that really matters, that we're mostly interested in, like complex carbon chemistry, occurs inside the medium of liquid water. Are there other mediums that we need? We know we need some liquid solvent mediums. Liquids have very good properties. We'll review some of those in just a second. Things like, you know, the ability to have high heat capacity, the ability to let you transport nutrients in and transport wastes away. So we know that some kind of liquid solvent medium is probably useful. Probably gas phase origin for complex chemistry in life is not going to work, and there's a lot of reasons why not. Final piece is this idea of protection from harmful UV light. This is a picture, by the way, of one of the more recent ozone holes over the southern hemisphere, of the Antarctic. It's been opened up by the chlorofluorocarbons in the upper atmosphere. We have a shield of ozone in our atmosphere, up high up in the stratosphere. Ozone molecule and the oxygen molecule, but the ozone molecule especially, has very strong opacity in the ultraviolet. It blocks UV radiation from getting down to the surface. UV radiation is bad for life as we understand it. It causes a lot of mutation. Mutations do a number of bad things. It can inhibit the emergence of complex life. In fact, we saw on our Earth, in the history of life, it wasn't until we had a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, and therefore an ozone layer, that the UV radiation on land dropped to the point that creatures could migrate from a marine environment to a land environment. We always got to remember, life through most of the history of the Earth was marine life. It wasn't until the ozone layer was established that land could be colonized, first by plants and fungi, then by animals, but it took a very long time. So this ozone layer is one way you can protect from UV radiation. It's one we're intimately acquainted with. But there's other ways you can do this. If you've got an ocean world, you can live underwater. After all, through most of life's history on the Earth, life lived in the water, where it was shielded from ultraviolet radiation. We've also found forms of life that live underground. For example, endoliths are types of microbiological creatures that live deep in the Earth, far from any ultraviolet radiation. So rock or ice can block UV radiation. Liquid water can block UV radiation and give rise to marine life. The ozone layer can block UV radiation in an atmosphere and give you the ability to access the surface, the very surface of the planet, if it's got solid surfaces to stand on. So those are the basic requirements. Let's take them sort of piece by piece and look at some of the details of how we can apply them now to this question of using them through the solar system. So let's start with the sunlight. The sun is the primary source of energy for powering life in the solar system. It heats planetary surfaces. We know on Earth it's important for photosynthesis. The thing is, how much sunlight you get depends upon how far away you are from the sun. If you're close to the sun, sunlight's really bright, maybe too bright. Too far away, there's too little sunlight and it's too cold. The sun's brightness depends upon the distance as 1 over the square of the distance. So one of the few equations we'll see in this class, the brightness of the sun depends upon L, which is the luminosity of the sun, how bright it really is, the total number of watts coming off its surface. It's kind of like the wattage of a light bulb. It's how bright it is no matter what. That's the total energy output from the body of the sun itself. And it's divided by 4 pi, that's basically an area, surface area of a sphere, times the distance squared. So the way you can see that is it's just pure geometry. If I've got sunlight coming off a certain patch of the surface, there's a certain amount of watts coming off that patch of the surface, which emerges out into an area. At 1 astronomical unit, this is how much that sunlight spread out. I go 2 astronomical units, I spread it out over 2 squared, or 4 times the area. So the same amount of light is passing through this block, it's just spread out over 4 blocks instead of 1. I go out 3 astronomical units, and I spread it out over 3 by 3, or 9 of those blocks. Again, same number of photons flowing through this cone moving outwards from the sun, but as you get further and further away, it gets spread out. So if I have a planet that's that big, in here it gets a certain amount of sunlight. But by the time I go out here, it's only getting the sunlight from that inner square, or 1/9. So that's why yesterday I could say Saturn is 10 times further from the sun, therefore it gets 1/100th the sunlight of the Earth. I'm simply taking the distance and squaring it. What this means is sunlight power falls off very fast. It falls off as the square of the distance away. It also works in the other direction. As you move closer, you get brighter as the square. So if I go from 1 AU to a half an AU, I get 1/1 squared, or 4 times the solar radiation. On Earth, solar radiation is about 1 kilowatt per square meter. On a planet that's a half an AU from the sun, it's 4 kilowatts per square meter. If I go out to Saturn, which is 10 times further away, 1 kilowatt per square meter now becomes 1/100th of 1 kilowatt per square meter, or just 10 watts per square meter. It's not much. So this is very important. How far I am from the sun determines how much solar heating I get on my surface, how much sunlight's available for photosynthesis, for example. This is an example of what's called an inverse square law. So we often refer to this as the inverse square law of brightness. It gets fainter as the square of the distance. Okay, this is the second scary equation. You actually saw this equation on your homework, but I actually worked out a numerical version of it rather than giving you the full evil form. The amount of solar heating you get on your surface depends upon two things. First of all, how far you are from the sun, how much sunlight you get in bulk. And then, remember, solar heating is a balance between how much sunlight you receive and how much you radiate away. If you were a perfectly black body, you would absorb every single photon that hit you. Well, things aren't perfectly black. They're kind of shiny, right? The screen is a shiny white. Ices are shiny white. Sand is kind of in between. Dark ground is kind of a few percent. So some fraction of the sunlight that hits a body will reflect off. So I have to take into account the shininess of the surface. If the light bounces off, it doesn't go into heating, right? It doesn't get absorbed. You've got to absorb it to heat. So I take this factor here called A. It's called A is for the albedo. For those of you who noticed the little B there, that's because it's actually what's called the bond albedo in this definition. Albedo is simply a way of measuring the body's brightness. And it works in the direction that a body with zero albedo is perfect black, a perfectly black body. It's as darker as the darkest thing you can make with carbon black. Albedo of 1 is 100% reflective. Every photon that comes in bounces off. If I put 0 here, then I would get the equilibrium temperature simply scales like 1/√ of the distance. If I had an albedo of 100% shiny, 1 - 1 is 0. There would be net zero heating if you were perfectly reflective, because you don't get any absorption. You just shine everything away. So shiny things are colder. Dark things are hotter at the same distance from the sun. The dark thing can absorb more energy. It heats up more. Shiny thing reflects more light, heats up less. So in words, what this scary-looking equation here says is, first of all, it depends upon 1/√ of the distance. You'll recognize this from homework problem number 1. More distant an object is, the less sunlight it receives. The less sunlight it receives, the cooler it is. The top part is what I just said. The shinier an object is for the same amount of sunlight, the cooler it is because it doesn't absorb as much, right? If you wanted to stay cool on a hot summer's day, you don't wear black. You wear white, shiny. In fact, if you really want to stay cool, you'd wear aluminum foil. Now, people would think you were crazy, but you would be cool. Okay, so your shiniest, if you want to cool off in a situation of high radiation, wear something shiny. It'll bounce off some of that light so you don't absorb it and heat up. This chart here shows you different types of materials that we find on the surfaces of, like, the Earth and how shiny they are. Fresh snow is really white, so it's really shiny. If you have a fresh coating of snow on a continent and you have broad daylight, it still stays really cold. Why? Because the sunlight's mostly bouncing off and going back out into space. Clouds are fairly shiny. That's why they're kind of white and puffy. But then we get to things like sand, clear ice, wet sand, which is dark, dry soil, desert soils. And then finally, really rich dark soils can get under 10%. A lot of forest organic matter. The forest floor is about 10% reflective. Those are places which are very strongly absorptive of solar energy. So dark surfaces absorb a lot, shiny surfaces absorb a little. Dark surfaces get warmer, shiny surfaces stay cooler. Let's do a more concrete example. Oops, in the solar system. Here's the moon. It's a dark rock, only a few percent reflective. It's got an albedo of about 12%, and it's only one astronomical unit from the sun. Its temperature is about 270 degrees Kelvin. That's how much you heat the rock. Enceladus, which is an icy moon of Saturn, it's super shiny, fresh ice, about 99% reflective. It varies. The distance, the actual distance now, is not 10 AU, but 9.54 AU. I plug it in, and its temperature is 30 degrees above absolute zero. So all I've done is go out 10 astronomical units. I shouldn't have dropped in temperature that much. If I would move the moon out to 10 AU, then it would drop in temperature by the square root of 10, which is about a factor of, you know, round numbers 3, so it would have been about 90 degrees Kelvin. But I didn't just move it further. It's now covered with shiny ice, so it's reflecting a lot of light, and it gets colder still. So I can make an object colder than it would be at a given distance if I just make it shinier. And when you're out really cold, one of the ways to make it shiny is put fresh ice on the surface. So the outer bodies of the solar system, if they're covered in shiny ices, are going to be really, really frigid cold places. So that's one of the factors that feeds into having available solar energy, right? Solar energy on Enceladus is really cold because not only is it far away, it's super shiny. The moon is warm, but there's no life on the moon. Why is that? Well, it's because there's no atmosphere, and water cannot be liquid at 270 degrees Kelvin in a vacuum. So you can't have liquid water, so the moon is lifeless. So this is one of the ways of looking at where we're going to look for life. We want to look at life in a zone where sunlight's pretty effective. But there's a caveat. And the caveat is these dudes, the extremophiles. Remember them? They're the ones that can get adapted to extremely hot, extreme environments, high temperatures, high salinity, high acids. What extremophiles tell us is that sunlight is not the whole story. It's not the only energy source in play. For example, we have hot life. These are microbes that are surviving near nearly boiling water glaciers, either in glacial geysers, either in geyser pools, for example, the big pool, thermal pools out at Yellowstone National Park, like Rainbow Springs here, have thermophile bacteria living in them. That water's hot enough to sterilize anything else or kill any animals that go in. The bright colors here come from some of the minerals. Or you have these tube worms that live down near deep ocean thermal vents. Deep in the ocean, too deep, sunlight doesn't penetrate down to the bottom of the ocean, but they're thriving away because they're getting heat from the surrounding hot water, and they're getting their energy, their metabolism is being powered by inorganic oxidation, not sunlight, right? In addition to photo, there's chemo energy. We saw that last time. Ketoautotrophs, these happen to be chemoheterotrophs, but they're also chemoautotrophs. We also know that there is dark life, life that lives in places where it's completely black, either deep in the earth, deep in the ocean, or even deep buried in polar ice. Just the other day, the Russians may have broken through into Lake Vostok, which is more than 2 miles below the polar ice in the Antarctic. It's liquid water down there. This is a place that's been a lake for probably 10, 20 million years. I don't know the exact numbers. I'm trying to follow the story. Liquid water deprived of sunlight for 20 million years. What's down there? Well, hopefully we're going to find out pretty soon. We don't know. But that's one place where life could exist. It's shielded from UV radiation by being underwater and under ice, but it's also shielded from sunlight. So there are other places where life can exist where the sun doesn't shine, where there is a source of heat. Why is there liquid water under the ice in Lake Vostok under the Antarctic? Because of a combination of all the pressure from 2 miles of ice above it and the heat coming up from the Earth below. The Earth is warm on the inside. So there are other sources of energy besides sunlight. So sunlight's not the whole picture. We've got to keep that in mind when we go looking through the solar system for life. If we only think sunlight, we may be missing the actual more promising places for life in our solar system. Another requirement for life is a liquid medium. We've said this before. You've seen this slide before. In fact, I just pulled it off of a lecture we gave just a week or so ago. For complex chemistry to occur, especially the complex chemistry that we know is involved even with the simplest forms of life on our planet. It requires a liquid solvent for that chemistry to occur, or liquid medium. Okay? It's a place for the reactions to occur. They need to be somewhere. Something has to get those chemical components together, and liquids are very good ways to transport chemicals around. It also can act as a transport medium bringing nutrients, say dissolved carbon dioxide or dissolved water, to the organism. The organism is going to have metabolism. The metabolism produces waste products. The water can carry those waste products away. If they were just sitting in a puddle of their own poop, as it were, they would eventually poison themselves, eat up all their nutrients, and probably poison themselves with their own waste products. But if you're in flowing water, you're always bringing in fresh nutrients and carrying away your waste products and maintaining a balance in your environment. The other thing that liquids do is liquids are good, very good at transporting heat away or holding on to heat. We call this the thermal capacity or the heat capacity of a medium. How much heat can you pump into the system without changing its chemical properties? Can you push a lot of heat into water? You actually can. You can push a lot of heat into water before it vaporizes, if it's in a liquid state, and you can take a lot of heat out of water before it freezes. So you get a wide range of temperatures. Some liquids might only be water, or I'm sorry, some compounds may only be liquid in a very narrow range of temperatures, and that may be too restrictive. Of course, we're going to see an example later, and you're doing an example on your homework. What is it that sets the temperature range in which water is liquid? It's actually more complicated than just simply saying 0 to 100 Celsius. That's on the surface of the Earth. What if we put it on Venus or Mars? It behaves differently. The final thing is that the liquid medium provides a protection from the outside. We've already seen an example of that in terms of ocean life or water, marine life. Water protects the life embedded within it from ultraviolet radiation. Sunlight barely penetrates the top surface of bodies of water. So liquid solvents have a lot of real advantages to us. Place to swim. When we look around at possible solvents, water is the ideal solvent, okay? It's very abundant. There's lots of it. That's good. You don't want to have the ideal solvent being something super rare. You want something that's just common as, well, water everywhere. It's liquid over a very large range of temperatures, from 0 degrees to 100 degrees Celsius under normal temperature and pressure conditions, under normal pressure conditions on the surface of the Earth. This is ideal in terms of thermal energy for a lot of the chemical reactions important for life. Water has another virtue. It's a great solvent. A lot of organic compounds, especially, readily dissolve in water. Water also dissolves minerals. It dissolves salts. That has a number of advantages. You can dissolve phosphorus salts, and therefore you have bioavailable phosphorus. You can dissolve sulfur and have bioavailable sulfur. We know that amino acids, DNA, use sulfur and phosphorus. The ATP cycle is a phosphorus cycle. Water can dissolve carbon dioxide and oxygen readily, so it's a way of having dissolved gases. The raw materials of metabolism are oxygen for breathing. Fish get their oxygen from dissolved water. Carbon dioxide. Some of the deep sea life actually can absorb carbon dioxide dissolved in water and use it for producing energy. The deep sea vents where the extremophiles live use carbon dioxide dissolved in seawater as their source of raw carbon. They're chemoautotrophs. Another interesting, although it's a property of water, is it's less dense when it freezes. That's kind of an odd one, but if it freezes, it floats. So if it floats, eventually you form an ice cap in which you can have liquid water below. If water ice was denser than liquid, when it froze, it would sink. And then you just build it up from the bottom until you froze the whole thing solid from top to bottom. So having the ice form, the solid form, less dense than the liquid form, lets you form a protective cap and actually make a separation between the frozen zone and a liquid zone. Of course, eventually you can freeze all the way down if you get cold enough. But it's a form of protection against an environment. So, for example, lakes freeze. Well, under normal winters, lakes in the northern hemisphere freeze over. But fish can sleep in the bottom where it's still liquid because the ice is floating on the top. All the fish in the pond don't die unless you freeze the thing solid all the way to the bottom. And finally, it has a high surface tension, and that means that there's a nice barrier between air and liquid. If there was a very low surface tension, you'd evaporate very easily. You'd be able to be turbulently stirred up and burst into the air, and there's all kinds of bad things when your surface tension is low. It also means you can make nice little confined bubbles of things and pools of things. So there's lots of useful properties water has. We like water. Water seems to be the basis of life on Earth. When we looked at the study of extremophiles, the one thing we found about extremophiles is you can adapt to extreme temperatures, extreme salinity, extreme radiation, extreme acid, hell, extreme just about anything except extreme dryness. No water, no life. The driest places on Earth in the Atacama Desert, some of those places are sterile to a meter or so below the surface because there's absolutely no water. So no water, no life seems to be the only thing we've ever found, the only way to push the environment other than, you know, nuking it, that seems to truly sterilize something is you simply remove all the water and boom, that's it. Is that true all through the solar system and the universe? It seems like a reasonably good assumption. But is water the only game in town? And the answer is no. There actually are other liquid solvents that have some properties that are pretty promising. Water, H2O, is liquid from 0 to 100 degrees Celsius, so that's a pretty big range. We've already talked about its properties. Ammonia becomes liquid. In fact, ammonia is often transported as a liquid in pure form, but it's liquid from minus 78 to minus 33 degrees Celsius. That's a pretty big range. That's 45 degrees Celsius. The problem is, that's not a very good range for chemistry, we think. But there are some forms of chemistry, even organic chemistry, very slowly, can actually occur in liquid ammonia, and people have done this. Now, when I say liquid ammonia here, NH3, do not confuse this with cleaning ammonia, which is anhydrous ammonia. That's basically ammonia gas dissolved into water. That's a different compound. That's the nasty stuff in Windex. This ammonia really is a cryogenic liquid, cryogenic meaning ice forming. If you brought water into contact with liquid ammonia, it would freeze because it's 78 to minus 33 degrees Celsius. That's below zero Celsius, which is the freezing point of water. Methane, CH4, is liquid from minus 182 to minus 164 degrees Celsius. That's a pretty narrow range, but it is liquid. Now, we're not certain what kind of chemistry can go on at those low temperatures, but some actually does. Whether it's, say, complex enough to be life-bearing, we don't know. So people are actually beginning to explore this. The other gas that turns out to be liquid over a reasonable range, a very surprising one, is ethane. Okay, methane is a carbon with four hydrogens. An ethane is two carbons. I have six bonds left, and I populate those with hydrogen, so it's C2H6. It's a little inline molecule. It's actually synthesized fairly straightforwardly from methane, so it's actually a natural concomitant. Whenever you find methane, you always find small amounts of ethane, especially if you've got solid surfaces around. Now, ethane is liquid from minus 183 to minus 89 degrees Celsius. That's cold, but it's not ridiculous. But look at the range, 94 degrees Celsius. That's a big range. So while methane may not be such a great medium because it's got a narrow range, if there's some chemistry that can go on this cold, ethane might actually be a promising medium. It has three phases, gas, solid, and liquid, and it actually can go into, in certain cases, you can imagine, ethane-like cycles, perhaps. We don't think this occurs in our solar system. We do see a methane cycle in our solar system on the moon Titan. Ammonia is not found in our solar system in a liquid form, and it's found mostly in ice form in the outer Jovian planets. And water, of course, is found on the Earth. Maybe it's on Mars frozen. Europa and Enceladus are all water ice bodies with possible liquid components. So these open up some possibilities. Maybe there's ammonia life somewhere else in the universe. Are there conditions in which ammonia is the dominant liquid? Or maybe ethane? We don't know, but we're certainly, people are beginning to study this and ask, are there kinds of complex chemistries that can go on at these low temperatures? This may be really slow life, but maybe catalytic reactions and things like that that we know are the precursors to life could occur in these media. So there are other possibilities. Maybe in our solar system, maybe elsewhere. We've got a lot of other environments to look at. The other thing that life kind of needs is a place to stand or a place to swim. It's one thing to say, I need a liquid, but you've got to put that liquid somewhere. You've got to have it pool up on the ground, and things can either swim in it, or if you have dry land, you can stand on that land. Places that have surfaces are the small rocky bodies, the terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and These small, rocky, and icy moons that are found in the outer solar system, the four Galilean moons of Jupiter, the big moons of Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The gas giants are really large, but they're gas giants. They have no solid surfaces. So the places we need to find where we might have puddles of stuff are on the various terrestrial planets or on the small rocky moons, probably the bigger ones, the Galilean moons, Titan, and some of these other icy bodies around Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. So these are the places we should be looking. So we're going to kind of stop talking about the Jovian planets from here on out, except to keep coming back to them as examples of too big an atmosphere. What does the body of the planet tell you about possibilities of habitability? So let's take a look at these solid bodies. And let's focus for now on the terrestrial planets. We'll come back to those other bodies in a moment. One thing we know is that the Earth, we saw the other day, and we know from our study of the Earth, is the Earth has a lot of internal heat. The Earth is molten on the inside. The Venus also appears to be molten on the inside. It has active geology and relatively young surfaces. Mars and the Moon and Mercury are not geologically active. They're geologically ancient and pretty much geologically dead surfaces. So one of the ways in which heat can be important, internal heat to a planet, is if you have enough internal heat to be molten, you can drive convection currents in a mantle. If you drive convection currents in a mantle, that's what powers plate tectonics on the Earth. That's what powers the vertical tectonics of upwelling and downwelling on the planet Venus. The other thing that can happen is plate tectonics, as we've seen on the Earth, plays a role in the carbon dioxide cycle. It's part of the regulation process of regulating the planet's temperature by removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through rainout and then returning it through volcanism to set up a balance. I take too much carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere gets too cold because the greenhouse effect collapses, and water freezes. Volcanoes, however, don't care what the outside temperature is. They belch more carbon dioxide back into the environment and restore the balance, and I get a nice negative feedback loop called the carbon dioxide cycle. But if the Earth were so cold that it solidified on the inside and shut down tectonics, it shuts down volcanism, and I eliminate the carbon dioxide cycle. I upset the thermal regulation cycle of our climate. So this is actually pretty important. We have a carbon dioxide regulated climate in large measure because we are a geologically active planet. Make the planet too old or too small and too cold, you don't get that regulation. And the atmosphere evolution and the atmosphere you get will be very different, even if you start from the same point that the Earth does. The other thing this convection can do, especially the convection in the deep interior, if it happens in the metallic portions of the planet, is that metallic convection drives electric currents which generates magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields come out and generate a giant planetary magnetic field. The giant planetary magnetic field is actually useful to us because, among other things, it acts as a shield. It keeps charged particles pouring off the sun and cosmic rays from reaching the surface of the Earth by deflecting them magnetically. So it prevents the dangerous particles from getting to the ground. If I had a bare naked atmosphere sitting out in the solar wind, it would slowly get ablated, slowly get eroded away by the continuous buffeting from the solar wind. But the magnetic field of the Earth makes that solar wind stand off a bit outside the atmosphere and acts like a magnetic shield. It keeps the solar wind from contacting our atmosphere and from blowing it away. So magnetic fields actually play a role in the habitability of our Earth. It's helped preserve and keep our atmosphere heavy enough to be a useful greenhouse effect. So let's now take a look at, well, what's the factor that determines internal heat? Well, as we saw the other day, the internal heat depends upon the cooling time. If you're a big body, and now I'll quantify it, if you're more than 50% the mass of the Earth or bigger, you're going to still be big enough to still be hot interior 4.5 billion years after formation. If you're hot enough in the interior, you're going to be hot and you're going to be molten. That means you're going to have active geology and tectonics of some kind, whether it's vertical or lateral. Venus is vertical, Earth is lateral. And you might have a magnetic field. Now, Venus doesn't have as strong a magnetic field as the Earth does, but the Earth has a nice, big, powerful magnetic field. If your planet or moon is less than 50% the mass of the Earth, by 4.5 billion years after formation, you will have solidified all the way through, or most of the way through. If you solidify in your interior, your mantle stops convecting and you completely shut down tectonics. No more volcanoes, no more plates, no more rifts. Done. Second thing you do is you shut down the magnetic field. You may have had one in the past when you were molten, but as soon as you stop convecting, the dynamo shuts off and the magnetic field simply fades away. That removes your magnetic shield. And that will dramatically alter both the protection of the atmosphere from solar wind, and then the shutting down of tectonics shuts down any carbon dioxide regulation cycle that might have been set up if there was liquid water present. So the size of the planet actually matters. Whether you have a molten, active interior in a magnetic field or not is a factor in the habitability of the planet because it affects what kind of atmosphere you will have. Okay, this idea of the planetary magnetic field being a shield, I've kind of already gone over, but here's a concrete example. Again, the Earth, as I've mentioned, has a magnetic shield that basically deflects the solar wind from striking our atmosphere. As a consequence, it acts like a shield. It keeps the solar wind from eroding the Earth's atmosphere away. Mars has long since solidified. When Mars was young, it was molten on the inside, had convection, had a magnetic field. Solar wind kind of blew around it. But as Mars solidified, the magnetic field simply collapsed. And when the magnetic field collapsed, the solar wind could strike the Martian atmosphere directly and begin to peel it off. What do we see today? Mars barely has an atmosphere. Part of the reason why Mars barely has an atmosphere is that the solar wind helped along what was already losing atmosphere due to the fact it had low gravity. So it's one thing to have low enough gravity that you can barely hold on to your atmosphere, but if something's going against you all the time, it kind of helps you along and accelerates the process. So Mars has a very thin atmosphere today because it in part lost it due to the interaction with the solar wind after its magnetic field collapsed, after its interior cooled. So this really has an impact. It means there's going to be sort of a minimum size that can have an atmosphere at a certain age. Again, at a certain age is important because when Mars was a billion years old, it had probably a big magnetic field. It was a lot hotter. It was geologically active. The geological activity, and I said the wrong number the other day, ended on Mars about 300 million years ago. But major geologic activity probably ended after the first billion years or so. It was only down to a few hot spots by the end. This retention of atmospheres is one of the real key pieces here. Now remember, we said before, we've seen this plot before, so this again is a repeat. It's kind of, like I said, it's kind of a review and bring it all together's lecture. Your ability, if you're a planet, your ability to hold on to an atmosphere depends upon two factors. The first of those is your mass. How much mass determines how much gravity you have. The more gravity you have, the higher the escape speed, so the hotter an atmosphere you can hang on to. Because you can hang on to the gases, they're not going to be moving so fast they escape. And the second thing that matters is your temperature. If you get super hot, even if your gravity is big, you can start to evaporate. The gases can begin to gravitationally escape from the upper part of the atmosphere. If, on the other hand, you're really cold, the molecules that make up your atmosphere are moving much more slowly, and a smaller, cold body can often hold on to an atmosphere better than a big, hot body. We see examples all over the solar system. Again, these lines represent the escape point of different gases. Hydrogen and helium as the red, green, and blue lines on top. Methane, water, nitrogen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide are the orange, cyan, black, and purple lines in this bottom band. The Earth and Venus, the tops of their atmospheres are pretty warm. We're pretty close to the sun, but they're pretty big planets. Their gravity's strong, so they're strong enough to hold on to water, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide. But they're not strong enough to hold on to hydrogen and helium. So we don't have hydrogen and helium in our atmospheres. If you're Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, not only are you further out in the solar system where you're colder, but you're big enough to hold on to even hydrogen and helium. They have big hydrogen and helium heavy atmospheres. Mars, while it's much smaller, if Mars was out where the Earth was, it wouldn't even be able to barely hold on to carbon dioxide. But Mars is further from the sun and cooler, and therefore it can hold on to its gases. But only very tenuously. It isn't helped by the fact it's going to be getting blasted by the solar wind for 4 billion years. The moons of the moon, too small, can't hold on to anything. The moons of Jupiter, they really can't hold on to much either. They're kind of a little bit too cold. Maybe they could hold on to a little methane, a little water, but water is ice out here, so you're not going to have a gas there. But Titan is small, but it's cold enough that it can hold on to nitrogen and methane. And in fact, Titan has a heavy nitrogen-methane atmosphere. So this ability to retain an atmosphere is a factor of size. Okay, so the other factor in the habitability of a planet is, okay, I build an atmosphere, I can hold on to an atmosphere. How big is that atmosphere? How heavy is that atmosphere? If the body's too small, we've already mentioned that, you lose your atmosphere completely, like Mercury. But if your body is too big, you build a really heavy hydrogen-helium atmosphere. This is going to make very high pressure, very hot conditions. That's not going to be very conducive to life. Extremophiles only get so far, maybe too hot for liquid water, and the high pressures may give you really weird chemistry and phases that you're just not going to get any life chemistry going on. Especially since if you've got a lot of hydrogen under high temperatures and pressures in these atmospheres, you get what's called reducing chemistry. You get hydrogen chemistry. So you don't form carbon dioxide. You don't form nitrogen molecule. You form methane and ammonia. You always form water. So you don't get the oxygen chemistry that's very common in Earth life. That's part of organic chemistry. You get organic chemistry, but it's a reducing chemistry. It's a different chemistry altogether. So let's try to sort of summarize this a little bit. I'm going to show you this plot. We've seen this before. This is our solar system laid out by distance from the sun along the horizontal axis. The vertical axis is your mass and units of the mass of the Earth. There's the Earth, Venus, Mars, and Mercury and Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The Moon, the four Galilean satellites of Jupiter, Titan, and Triton are in orange. The dwarf planets, the big ones, Ceres, Pluto, and Eris, I've dropped off Makemake and Haumea just for clarity, are in purple. The asteroids in greens, the Kuiper Belt object ice balls are kind of in this sort of sea blue. Got a lot of factors at play here. The first of these factors is if you're below this gray band, so now when you're moving out, you're getting colder, so you can be a little bit smaller and still hold on to an atmosphere. But if you're below this band, you're too small to hold on to an atmosphere. And so what do we see? Well, the Moon and Mercury fall below that line. They're airless. They don't hold on to their atmosphere. They're too small. But Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are above the line. They can build an atmosphere. Titan can build an atmosphere. Triton and Pluto are below the line. Eris is just marginally above the line. Probably doesn't have an atmosphere. A couple of the Galilean moons here could potentially have an atmosphere, but don't. So the line is not hard and fast. It's a little fuzzy. Ceres, all the asteroids and those, they're too small to have atmospheres. But there's another limit for an atmosphere. If you're really big, you build a hydrogen-helium atmosphere, and then your atmosphere is too heavy. So here we draw the gray line. Everything in the gray zone above this band here is so big that you immediately build a hydrogen-helium atmosphere. So, no atmosphere, too much atmosphere, just right. It's kind of a Goldilocks problem. Not too little, not too much. This white band is just right. So look at the entire area of the solar system. There's only a narrow band. Now, this yellow band is if you're below this line, you will have cooled off by 4.5 billion years, and your interior is solid. Mercury, Mars, and the Moon are solid. So are most of, at least we think so, should be, the Galilean moons, Titan, Triton, and all these. They have solid interiors. No geology below the line. No plate tectonics. Only Venus and Earth are above the line today. So this is another piece of habitability. Now let's add the last piece. This water-colored line is the band where liquid water can exist on the surface of these worlds. That little blue box is where you can have an atmosphere and potentially have water. It's a very narrow zone. And the green line is where methane or ethane could be a gas at 1 atmosphere pressure. Titan just falls in the box. So by using those considerations, we've actually strongly narrowed down where we might be. But there's a difference. And that is, some of this line is based on sunlight heating of an upper atmosphere. Maybe we're being too provincial. There's some other possibilities hiding here. Mars used to be above this line, used to be in the zone of water, used to have an active geology, but it doesn't today. So where should we be looking? Well, Mars could have been above that line, may have had liquid water and a thicker atmosphere in the past. So let's look at Mars maybe as a past position of life. Europa and Enceladus are places where an ice cap may be holding oceans below there. So while they're in the cold zone where we might not look, their geologic conditions actually allow for liquid water subsurface. So there are possibilities. And finally, let's not rule out Titan. We don't know that liquid water is the only story. What about places with liquid methane? And we do know that they have complex organics. So these are where we're going to go look. Mars, Europa, Enceladus, and Titan. And that's where we're going to go starting tomorrow.